You're listening to WPRK, Winter Park, Florida, 91.5 FM. It is 9 in the morning, 9:03, and this is the Sands Per Hour.
Hey, yay.
How are you doing, Amir?
I'm doing good, Greg. How are you, Matt? How about yourself?
I'm good. What do we have on today's show?
We had a lot of things. But the main premise is that four-letter word we all know as love.
Yes. And why is that?
Why is that? Well, the next Sandspur will be coming out this Thursday, which is, drumroll, Valentine's Day.
That's right.
Yeah.
You are correct.
Yes, it's Cupid and Aphrodite and all that jazz.
That is correct. And that's why today we have an interview with Dr. Claire Strom from Rollins History Department.
Yes.
She will be talking about her class, The History of American Sexuality.
Yep, yep.
We will also be talking to, well, our pre-recorded interview with Dr. Lucy Littler and her about her class writing about love.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be discussing some V-Day movies.
V-Day movies, anti-V-Day movies, all that stuff.
And then the Peanuts gang.
Peanuts, yes. Charlie Brown and his love with the little red-haired girl. So that'll be interesting, too.
And so all of that, and we also have at 9:50 our Facebook contest.
Facebook contests.
Where you can win a Gertz Berry gift card, and that will be going on at 9:50 if you get on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thesandspur, where you can follow us, find out breaking news, and also perhaps win a gift card.
Perhaps.
But we're going to start with our interview with Dr. Claire Strom, and you will hear that right now. History of American Sexuality. How is sexuality discussed from a historical perspective?
When we think about sexuality in terms of history, we look at how people's understanding of sex has changed over time as attitudes towards religion, the family, homosexuality, marriage, and other phenomena that affect sexuality have changed.
How is American sexuality in the past different from today, but also how is it similar?
Well, it depends when in the past. And one of the things that's interesting about teaching the history of American sexuality is we are able to go back and look at ways in which colonial sexuality was similar, more similar in some ways to the sexuality today, because there was a lot more tolerance for premarital sex than perhaps you would see in the 19th century. So it's something that hasn't evolved in a linear fashion, but comes and goes depending on the era. I think American sexuality today perhaps is more prudish than perhaps 50 years ago. So, for example, the 1960s perhaps was a more permissive era than today's era. But if you went back to the 1880s, then you would find a very different story. So, again, it's not linear, and I think you have to look at every time period and see how attitudes towards sex have been shaped by the society at the time.
Is there a moment in history where the idea of love and sex becomes romanticized and glamorized?
Certainly. I think you see a very an upswell in the idea of romantic love in the late 19th century. You get all of these beliefs. This is where you start to see the belief that you should actually love the person you marry. That was kind of a new idea. You see that again then in the 50s. You get the romantic movie era, Gone with the Wind, things like that. And it's interesting when I'm teaching my class, we do a lot with movies, and it's interesting trying to pull apart. So, for example, if we looked at The Last of the Mohicans, it's interesting to look at what was sex like in the 1750s, what was it like when James Fenimore Cooper wrote the book in the 1820s, and what was it like when the film was made in the 1980s. So, you know, you have these three different lenses that you're trying to, and I may have got those dates wrong, but there's three different lenses that you're trying to pull apart, which makes it an interesting discussion.
What major event in American history, be it war, political movements, etc., has most influenced our culture's sexuality?
I don't think you could pick one event. I mean, that's ridiculous, right? I mean, war always influences sexuality, but the influence is usually brief, right? You go to war, everyone starts making love with abandon because they might die at any point. So you have this huge upswell in premarital sex, a huge upswell in illegitimacy, a huge upswell in prostitution. But then, you know, several years after the war, that will all start to taper off. So what is the permanent influence? You could talk about the Stonewall Uprising, which really brought gay and lesbians to the forefront and gave them an identity and a movement. How significant is that? Well, I mean, that's only 30, 40 years old, so we don't know yet. You could talk about the move away from the church, but right now we've got the religious right trying to get us back to the church. So I think there can be no one movement, but one event, but there's a lot of events that affect our sexuality.
And so are you almost saying that none of these events are even permanent? Have we ever seen a permanent swing?
That's a good question. No, I don't think you can say any of these events are permanent. I think that's one of the things that's so nice about the history of sexuality is you can talk about it in terms of fluctuations and cycles rather than, you know, achieving an end. So,
what particular fact through history always gets a response from students?
Well, one of the reasons I love teaching this class is because I'm generally teaching it to younger people who have very active libidos and who, of course, as you know, you always hear, believe they have discovered sex. And so it's always fun to get them in a classroom and start talking about what people were doing in bed, out of bed, nowhere near a bed, in the 17th century, the 18th century, you know, start talking about, you know, for example, and you will remember this, we had a bestiality, there is a very famous bestiality case in the 17th century, and so we had a long discussion on whether it was actually possible to have sex with a turkey. And, you know, most of the students in my class probably have never thought about turkeys and colonial America in those terms. They've always probably put it together with Thanksgiving. But so it gives them new ways to think about the past that they find exciting. I find it exciting, and the discussion is always good.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Strom. Again, teaching History of American Sexuality from Amir Sadeh and Greg Golda at the Science Per Hour. We thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks. And again, we thank Dr. Claire Strom for her interview, and we applaud the different range of history classes that Rollins offers, and hers especially, one of the more popular ones.
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, a book class, and always something to talk about.
And now we will take you into our first song.
Yes, we will be playing Truly Madly Deeply by Savage Garden.
Let's hear it.
Love for this class because it's a topic that you can talk about in different contexts, different academic discourses. So, for example, we can read a novel which has love in it and talk about it from how a humanities scholar would write or talk about love. We can look at scientific studies, which we did last semester pretty effectively, looking at a study on oxytocin, which is commonly referred to as the love hormone. And how a scientific scholar makes an argument versus how a humanities scholar makes an argument. So I guess I don't know necessarily how one writes about love per se, but the different kind of argumentative styles in an academic context is what we focus on in this class.
And so does personal writing ever come into play when students are writing about different subjects that involve love? And do you try to draw that line between analytic and more personal anecdotes that might come out?
I believe in using personal writing, and the love theme can be helpful and dangerous depending on what the student wants to write about. Again, referring back to last semester, I did a personal narrative as one of the major essays and asked students to write about a moment in their lives when love came into play. They wrote about everything from winning a golf tournament to breaking up with a boyfriend to whatever, seeing their parents go through divorce. And starting out with a personal essay, an essay where they own the content, they don't have to learn material and then spit it back out, really can beef up a writer's confidence so that you can then move on to more analytic writing as the semester progresses. Unfortunately, I don't have time this semester to do a personal essay, but hopefully, again, I will in the future, because I really do think that's helpful, particularly for beginning writers, again, to help them build up their confidence. As far as personal writing on a day-to-day basis goes, I do often have my students do, I don't know if personal writing is the right word, but less formal free writing in the classroom a lot, because I want them to get in the habit of using that kind of personal time, that free space, to develop their ideas so that they're not always thinking about writing as something that you hand in for a grade, but writing as something you can use to help you figure out what you think. So I definitely think personal writing and informal writing have a place in the college writing classroom.
You mentioned confidence as a skill that a young writer could develop through working through personal material. Are there any other skills that you would see as a benefit as doing perhaps personal daily writing or anything of the sort?
Well, with personal daily writing, I think you just get more comfortable. You get better with it. You get better as the more you practice it. With regard to this specific class, a skill that I'm hoping my students learn is reading academic arguments so that they can then write their own. Whether they're reading how a scholar reads the novel Beloved, or how they're reading, or reading how a scientist writes about a love hormone, I want them to understand how the argument works so they can then move on to whatever their chosen major is and write effective arguments in those different disciplines.
Great. And you talked about some of the more personal subjects people might have tackled, mm-hmm. like winning a golf tournament and going through their parents' divorce. What are some other of the more exciting topics, maybe not personal ones, but the academic subjects that you saw as particularly interesting?
Sure. Well, with a class with a theme on love, you get lots of interesting stuff. Last semester, I had students do research projects on the portrayal of non-heterosexuality in pop culture. I had students write about online dating and its effectiveness. I had a lot of people focus on divorce, which I think is sadly a statement about the times. I had a lot of people write about... there was one really interesting about romantic comedies and how it skews the perception of romance. So all different kinds of things, from pop culture to much more personal stuff.
Great, and good luck with the rest of the semester and with your students' work.
Thank you.
And thanks to Dr. Lucy Littler for her interview. And before we start talking about Amir's writing about love, we will hear our next song, which
yes.
is...
Well, Greg, did you know what February 15th is?
February 15th, the day after Valentine's Day.
Yes and no. February 15th, celebrated by a group down in Brooklyn, New York, is Phil Collins Day.
Really?
Yes. As some of you may know or may not know, Phil Collins, I fancy his musical stylings. And when I heard about this celebration, which this year will be the 7th annual one, these people actually go out. They wear Phil Collins masks, regalia. They march down the streets of New York, and they play his music. And it's just a celebration. And the whole concept is that the day after Valentine's Day, that's the true day. You really need to listen to the musical stylings of Phil.
Mm-hmm.
When you think of love songs, Collins is your man. And this is why we go to Groovy Kind of Love by Phil Collins.
And that was Phil Collins with Groovy Kind of Love.
I mean, just an amazing song.
If you could just see the smile on Amir's face right now.
I was definitely jamming out to this. I mean, Phil Collins is my man. I love him to death. He just number one artist of all time, and just listening to his stuff always gets me in the mood.
Great, great, great. So now we talk about the Peanuts Gang.
Peanuts, yes. So I was writing an article. I decided to write an article for the Valentine's Day issue of the Sanspare, like I usually do. And this article talks about Peanuts in a way that I guess not many people focus on, or not many people, I guess, consider. Or they do, but maybe don't think about it consciously. And that is through the lens of unrequited love. I decided to look at Charlie Brown and the little red-haired girl, and kind of use that lens as to somewhat critique unrequited love and that concept that is permeated throughout literature and movies and culture for vast amount of decades.
And so, what'd you do to prepare to write this article?
I ended up watching as many Charlie Brown Valentine's Day specials as I could. So I love the internet. Internet's awesome for that. I kind of looked back at some of the old comic strips and kind of see how that was portrayed and how kind of Charlie Brown is as this romantic almost, I guess, this just somebody who's tragically in love with somebody who's just ever so afraid to talk to.
And so about the comic strip versus the shows, is there... Like, what is contained within, like, a three-panel strip that can convey this type of feeling that he has?
Well, a lot of it is in the comics. Again, it's somewhat limited. But the great thing is that there's multiple. They're, you know, week by week, they try and build on the story the best they can. But a lot of it is those one-liners, those zingers that Charlie Brown is very much known for. So the first two panels kind of set up the plot or set up, like, what's going on. And then the last one is, like, that kind of, oh, Charlie Brown type of moment. And actually, the funny thing is in the comics, you don't see the little red-haired girl. She's never actually drawn by Schultz. It isn't until the TV specials that you actually get a visual, like actual see her for the first time. So I found that was also very interesting to kind of... it's almost, especially in the comics, she's just this spoken-about entity, but not... real, and I kind of talk about this very godlike, idol-like way that Charlie Brown envisions her, which kind of lends to this type of relationship back and forth.
Right, it's almost like the reader also has to participate in that sort of imagination, and so it really takes on perhaps what they feel is their
little
ideal.
Girl.
Yes, exactly.
So, and I guess for me, it was very difficult because I love Charlie Brown. I mean, it's one of my favorite comic strips. I kind of talk about all my favorite things today. But it really is. I loved it since I was a kid, and I always very much felt I was Charlie Brown, you know, always that kind of like shy guy or whatever. But looking back on it now, you know, being 20 years old, I kind of was a little bit upset. I was kind of a little bit upset at Charlie Brown almost. And I kind of talk about that in there. It's like... You know, Charlie Brown, yes, you know, he's kind of, we all feel for the guy. We all know, we all have that one person that we really feel for and love and would do anything for, but we just don't have the ability to tell them we like them, or it's not at the right moment. But the way, I guess, Charlie Brown is portrayed, it goes to the nth degree to almost, you know...
Exaggerated,
and you... Especially looking back on it as an adult, or young adult at least, it's somewhat pathetic. It's somewhat, you know, it gets to the point where you're just like, no wonder she doesn't like you, Charlie. Like, you're a Debbie Downer. It's sad, but it's like, you know, you have to look at it, and the best way I can explain it is you have to look at it as if you're going on a blind date with a guy. and you'd never know him, because that's why we feel for him, because we know what he's going through. As the audience, we see all the trials and tribulations, and that's all stories of unrequited love. The reason why we as the audience feel for that person is we see their perspective. You don't really look at the person, the little red-haired girl, especially the person who may not feel the same way. And I feel that their story is also, you know, quite fascinating.
Right. So from the little redhead girl's perspective, who is Charlie Brown?
I mean, the way I see it, he's just some guy. Doesn't know him. Just somebody who she probably sees him across the playground, or I guess here, you know, in a college, maybe you see across the campus center. You know, you don't really notice him. You may see him around once in a while, but never really crosses your mind. And to hear, probably to hear that this person has such an infatuation for you, if you don't feel the same way, it can be almost stalkerish. It can be almost like, you know, you wanting to be the good person, you obviously appreciate it. You can find it flattering, but I bet a part of you is kind of like, well, don't feel the same way. Want to move on, Charlie Brown, or?
Right. And so when you're thinking about the message of the show, do you think that after a few viewings, it sort of takes on this message of what not to do?
Yeah, I think that really is it. I think it becomes almost a cautionary tale. It's like, you know, you at first feel bad, but afterwards you look and you see these are the things I shouldn't do. And again, the kid is like in elementary school. So I think that also, and I say that jokingly, but it kind of adds, it's like, it's almost like, what's your excuse, dude? Like it's like, it makes sense for him. He's a kid. Like, of course he's not going to know how to act, but it's almost as if like you're watching it, especially I say like when I'm older, I kind of realize, okay, like if I really care about somebody, if I'm really aching on them, and either I tell them and I kind of go for it, or, you know, I find something else. I go out there and put myself out there, because there's no point in putting that on yourself. I think that's one of the biggest things. It's like, there's no point in just completely throwing yourself into a situation and falling for somebody who doesn't feel the same way.
Right. So, cool things learned from maybe something you gave a watch when you were younger, but perhaps revisiting will teach you a thing or two, huh?
For sure. I think that's the big lesson.
Cool. And so we will go into our next song, which is...
Yes. I decided for this third song to not necessarily go with the stereotypical love song. I think love songs feel like they have to be these ballads and these soft things, but I decided to go with something a little bit more hard rockin'. You know, this is a college radio station. So I'm going to go... The song is Shimmer by Fuel.
All right, we ended up hearing a couple songs there. What was that second selection?
That second selection was from Billy Ocean, Love Really Hurts Without You, his first single ever, 1976, folks, taking you all the way back.
From one ocean to another, we will be talking about the Grammys coming up.
Yes, we will.
Yes, transatlantic or something. Okay, at any rate. Now, we invite you to join us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thesandspur, where we will be posting our question of the week. And it is online. And the question is, the Fox statue used to celebrate Fox Day originally represented a Rollins Men's Society. A statue of what animal, now missing, represented the Women's Society? And next week we will learn what that answer is, and we will talk about the history behind it. But as for now, you will win a Gertzberry gift card by being our first correct responder. So we will find out who that is, hopefully today.
Hopefully.
And now, as we teased, the Grammys were last night.
Yes, from Billy Ocean and now to Frank Ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Passing the torch.
No, I mean, it was an interesting show for sure. I mean, I guess it didn't have those huge moments. They did have a few, Justin Timberlake, Mr. Sexy Back, did come back for his suit and tie performance with Jay-Z. That was big, you know. It was definitely fun to see. I mean, obviously, people have been wanting Justin Timberlake to come back for a while, and he kind of teased it online for a little bit. But it was definitely good to see him come back. He definitely rocked it out. Like I mentioned, Frank Ocean, he won Urban Contemporary Album. Among other things, but I thought this was interesting because this is the first year the Urban Contemporary Album category has been created.
Okay.
So they never had an Urban Contemporary Album before until now.
So what does that mean?
Urban Contemporary Album is this new category. It's a subgenre. It's not necessarily R&B or hip-hop. It's kind of this this new format, which is kind of... It mixes a lot of different types of music to where it's not necessarily just like your traditional like Nas or 50 Cent, but it's also not, you know, your really soft like Brian McKnight. It's kind of a mixing of those.
Okay. I guess that works.
So like Chris Brownie. Chris Brown, he was also one of the nominees for that category. That's why he's the first one that drops to mind.
Yes.
So yeah, and also but kind of switching it, obviously Mumford & Sons won Album of the Year, which was great, with Babel. Song of the Year goes to Fun with We Are Young. Gotye also won Record of the Year featuring Kimbra with Somebody That I Used to Know. And Fun also won Best New Artist, which is an interesting category.
Right. It's sort of akin to your Rookie of the Year in a sport, which doesn't always guarantee future success in sports. And what can we say about the careers of those who win this Grammy?
It's checkered, for sure. It's actually, there's something called the New Artist Curse. And kind of winning this award, especially with artists back in the 70s and 80s, we were pretty much be it for them. They'd win the award, and that would be about it. A Starlight Vocal Band, which made, obviously, Afternoon Delight, one of the singers was quoted as saying that once we won that award, that was it.
They just stopped trying. They just knew it was over.
they said, looking back on it, he just knew, like, that was the moment. And a lot of artists, you kind of look back on them, and you see, like, what have they done? Right. Since then, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Give me one second so I can... Sure. Trying to pick up some of the past winners. Obviously, Fun has had a great year so far. I mean, they've...
Sure.
You know, Some Nights and We Are Young, I mean, you couldn't get away from it over this last year. I mean, just amazing songs. But it'll be interesting to see how far they go. Kind of looking now, have the list up. You know, some of these artists are still very well known, still big. I mean, we have Hootie and the Blowfish, Leanne Rimes, Lauryn Hill. I mean, classics, Christina Aguilera. So there are some people who have really made success out of this. But, you know, what about America? What's America been doing?
In America.
Or,
not to be confused with the...
Or 1979's winner, A Taste of Honey. You know, there are some artists that have won this, and a lot of you kind of see, it's almost like supposed to be this precursor that, like, you're the best new artist, and this is, you know, we see great things in your future, almost.
Right.
But it doesn't seem to be the case, you know?
Do you think that sometimes that... perhaps foreseeing the future of someone with promise could get confused with perhaps a one-hit wonder band?
Oh, for sure, for sure. I mean, famously enough, if in 1990, this was actually the one Grammy that was ever revoked because Milli Vanilli won the award.
Uh-huh.
And we all know what happens with Milli Vanilli. If you don't, Milli Vanilli won it in 1990, and when it was found out that they were actually lip-syncing and never the two artists never actually sung their lyrics, it was actually a bunch of other people, their award was revoked from them. And this was the first time, and still is the only time, a Grammy has ever been revoked. So some greats, some not so greats, you know, and it's very hard to, you know, one-hit wonders at the time, they aren't one-hit wonders. It's just a hit. It's your first hit. So there's a very big difference between one hit and the first. So it'll be interesting to see what Fun does. I have a lot of hope for them. I really like their stuff. Really hope that they keep on going.
Yeah. And maybe it could be the case of, again, I don't have this musical data in front of me, but maybe if you look at some of these albums of these one-hit wonder bands, maybe all their stuff is really sort of contained in one sort of sound, and maybe when they don't progress from that, you think that's a hindrance to their future success?
Probably, yeah. And I think also a lot of times categories, like they're, you'll look at the category that they're in, and it's like, well, at the time they were the best of the five. You know, there are just sometimes there are just years where stars aren't born. There aren't just legends that are magically like every year. And sometimes you'll look at the list. I'm looking at, you know, right now, kind of like Sheena Easton, and this one was actually quite interesting because actually there's a few really good bands, the Go-Go's, Luther Vandross, who had maintained long years of amazing hits. I mean, the Go-Go's have been still doing their thing, and the late Luther Vandross is just a institution when it just comes to that soulful music, that just those Here and Now or Dance with My Father. I mean, those are classics that you'll hear in weddings or you know, funerals, like just that one inspirational song. So it's very interesting to see that, you know, who is the best new artist.
Right. And as we close our show today, we want to remind you to pick up your copy of The Sandspur, which will be on stands this Thursday, featuring Amir's article on the Peanuts Gang and Unrequited Love. We also would like to tell you that next week we will be having Abbott Jones of the Brushing Literary Journal.
Ooh, that'll be interesting.
In studio. We will also be looking to get an update on Winter with the Writers.
That'll be a lot of fun.
Which is Roland's annual literary festival that is running currently. And if you don't have something going on this Valentine's Day, the Knowles Chapel on campus will be hosting Karen Russell, author of Swamplandia,
wow,
at 8 p.m. as their next author. And as always, you can follow The Sandspur on Facebook, facebook.com/TheSandspur, on Twitter, @TheSandspur, and you may email us at staff@thesandspur.org.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day, and we'll see you next week.